Good day, good evening, everyone. People are joining from North America and from Europe. So wherever you are, we hope you have a wonderful time with us. I would like to start us off by quoting one of my favorite books, if that's okay, Jenny. So
yes,
I'm actually going to start with a quote by Donna Hicks. Donna Hicks, for those of you who don't know, she's a Harvard professor. She's also an international negotiator of peace agreements, and she wrote one of the most guiding books for my personal leadership outlook, which is called Leading with Dignity. And I really thought two quotes out of this book really frame our conversation very well, Jenny. So I'm just going to read that. She said, "The challenges that leaders face are adaptive because they require them to push the boundaries of what they think they know, expand how they assign meaning to events, and include more of the complex human forces underlying issues. The change that is needed might have something to do with leaders' own way of thinking and their own actions and behaviors, which could be causing the dysfunctional dynamics within many organizations. These adaptive challenges require leaders to expand their consciousness and reduce their egocentrism." And I believe that as an organization, GOR is seen as a role model of adaptive leadership, of innovative leadership. But I have to say, I'm also immensely grateful for our personal connection and the way I experienced you as a leader and as a real role model in your role. So I'm very excited, Jenny, that you are joining us. I'm going to just quickly say a couple of words about you so that everyone anchors you somewhere, because this is what we typically do. But we're going to put that aside and really talk then a lot about what made you the leader you are today. And what is your personal outlook on leadership? And we weave in some questions around, of course, the quite unique and originally grown culture at GOR and what that really means in everyday life. So Jenny is an inspirational leader and systems thinker. This is what people say about you on LinkedIn. So I pulled that out from there. You have a passion to deliver significant growth for people, products, and businesses. And currently, you are the business operations head for Gore-Tex Fabrics. And you seek to transform the apparel industry to a sustainable future. I know out of first-hand experience how important sustainability is for you personally, but also for you as a company. And you have a strong expertise in product management, global expansion, market assessment, product launch, and leading highly engaged teams to support strategic growth initiatives. I know that these are a lot of buzzwords, but I fundamentally believe that this represents your reality every day. And quite in the spirit of these live podcasts, I would like to actually ask you my first question before we go into more personal introductions from your end. At GOR, you have something like 3,500 unique inventions, apparently, and more than 1,000 products. And I did this already to our guests from IKEA, so I'm going to do the same thing to you. I learned a lot about the different products. I learned that GOR produces strings for guitars, as well as equipment for NASA, as well as, of course, what we know, Gore-Tex, outdoor clothing, outdoor fabrics. Which product would you say is your favorite product, and why?
Oh, well, first of all, I am so glad to be here and getting to talk to you. It's always an inspirational time for me too. So my favorite GOR product, I mean, this is a big question because like you said, there's so much versatility in the products that GOR makes. So I have to go with two, if I can have two answers there. The first is most people know Gore-Tex apparel. And so I'll start with an example of that. Sitka is one of the GOR brands. And so there is a Sitka jacket called the Ambient Jacket, and it's just this perfect warm but not too warm and provides some wind resistance for the fall weather right now. I live in Massachusetts, so in New England of the United States, and we've had some very rainy weather and some cooler weather. Today's warm, but it's just this perfect jacket for watching my kids play soccer on the weekends right now. But this second one that I have to tell you about is a lot of my time at GOR has also been in our medical products. And one that is just like near and dear to my heart, is a product that I was able to lead from ideation through to clinical trial. It's in clinical trial right now, and it is for venous patients, so patients who have blood flow problems in their veins, in their legs, and it is called the Gore Viafort device, and it is in clinical trials right now.
Well, fantastic. Well, we should look those up. Thank you so much for sharing that. Every one of us, of course, has our own unique origin story. We know that from actual movies as well, right? The origin story is very important. And I would like to start our conversation by really talking about your origin story. And I'm going to hone in on one subject, but, you know, in our conversation, really take it as wide as you'd like. In preparation for our time together, I actually found an article that you wrote, and I was very moved by some of the words you published. So if it's okay, I would like to read them. I knew growing up that I had been considered a miracle baby. My parents tried to have children for many years unsuccessfully. They also tried adoption unsuccessfully. Due to a job change, they relocated to Columbus, Ohio, where the Ohio State University was doing early groundbreaking work on in vitro fertilization. My mom was one of the courageous women from the region to try the new treatment, and it was successful. I was the first baby both conceived and delivered at Ohio State, a story that has had lasting impact on my life. You say further on, pioneering efforts in fertility science are why I'm here, and what stuck back my interest in medical innovation, and it translated into you earning a PhD, of course, in bioengineering, so that you could as well work on life-changing healthcare technologies. So with this setup, tell us a bit, what is it like to have an origin story of being a miracle baby, and what does that mean growing up?
It's all I've ever known, is what I would say first. You know, you read exactly the situation. I knew growing up that I would be videoed on the news, and I was featured in newspaper articles. At the time, it was all de-identified. So my name, our address, any of our contact information was not included. And a lot of that was also because there were differing opinions about my origination. And some believed that that wasn't a pathway that should exist. So what it led me to really believe, you know, is learning from my mom. In many ways, I feel like I'm my mother's daughter. And my mom was so courageous and strong. In fact, she was one of the first female vice presidents at a very large bank. And so she fought against so many assumptions and norms and our ways of working. And she taught me things like never give up, challenge assumptions, find new ways, new approaches. Even in being one of the first in vitro fertilization babies, I knew it was even more than that. She experienced postpartum hemorrhage when she was pregnant, and they thought that I would not survive. And so many say it was a miracle that I did survive. And even when she went to give birth, because I was both the first that was conceived as well as delivered at Ohio State, the researcher wanted to be there for the delivery. And so she arrived in the middle of the night and said, call this this doctor. And they said, no, we don't call him in the middle of the night. And she was like, no, I insist. And they said, no, we don't do that. You're a patient. You don't know. And she said, well, then call and say a crazy lady is here and she won't stop until you call. And then he showed up. Of course, they did place the call. The researcher showed up as well. And so it taught me how to live courageously from the very beginning of my life. And it comes then being a miracle and being described that way as both an amazing blessing, an amazing opportunity, and somewhat of a weight that how do I live up to that? So, you know, why is it that I'm the one who's here? And it was made possible that I could be here. And then it makes me really want to give back in this world and use every amount of energy, passion, knowledge I have to make this world a better place and pay it forward, so to speak, for others who come after me.
Thank you. Well, thank you for sharing. Indeed, it sounds like it's a two-sided thing, right? On the one hand, I'm sure it's an uplifting story. On the other hand, it does come with huge responsibilities and weight that it carry. As you entered your professional life, was it your career goal to have a leadership career path, or what was it that was really the driving force behind suddenly the last 12 or so years within the GORE organization and before that in research?
I don't think I sought out being a leader, but I felt like that was a way to amplify the impact that I could have, because I had this strength in connecting with others, communicating with them, translating. Even from when I was doing my education, people would often tell me I had the strength in translating what was needed into the engineering principles. And so it almost felt like a natural extension to lead people. That was a big step, obviously. I think it's a big step in many people's career to go from being an individual contributor to leading others. And one of the ways I thought about it was I love solving these complex problems. And I would do that on the technical side. But an even bigger complex problem is how people work together and what motivates people and energizes people and how we create a vision. And so it was even more energizing for me, because enabling people to accomplish their potential even more than they imagine and believe is just the most rewarding experience that I've had. And so I think that's what led me to the leadership direction. It started as more of an informal leadership and mentoring others, helping others, and then went to a more formal leadership commitment, as we call it at GORE, that we commit to the role.
Love that we commit. It's fascinating when we speak about leadership, sometimes, right, a lot of the leadership attributes, a lot of the leadership language is so overused. The words are overused. The knowledge about it is overused, but it's in the spirit, in the way you live and you demonstrate leadership truly every day. So how do you exemplify it every day? How would you describe the way you engage with the people around you? Or maybe what would other people say in how you do that?
The way that others have described my approach to leadership has been with the analogy of a lighthouse. And the thought is, imagine a lighthouse. It's sitting out on a rocky coast. You know, it's generally the edge of the rocks are into the water. Maybe the water is choppy. It might be dark or not easy to see. And so the description has been that I then can provide this light to highlight the vision of where we're going, as well as shine the light where is needed to navigate any choppy waters, any rocks that might come, and that can provide a really engaging environment. Even though we're navigating the stormy seas or whatever it might be, that people are energized and know where we're going to make a difference. So that's the analogy that others have used to describe my way of leading.
Like that, some of the key words you said, right? Lighthouse, solving complex problems, courage, growth, and passion. I think those are essential ingredients in a way when we're responsible for other people. There is also, I would say, another element here that you and I recently talked about that I found quite inspiring as well, because yes, of course, you have an important role to play in a large system. Of course, you lead people in that, but you and I were also talking about your passion for horses and how horses and building rapport and a relationship and a connection with horses at one hand can be super easy, at the other hand it's also a much more immediate feedback, a much more sincere feedback in how do you build a connection. And so I found our conversation around this really very insightful. So as a person who is very passionate about the animal as such and who has built some deep connections with them, but also is quite successful, right, in professional competitions, how would you share some of the insights or translate some of the insights from the connection with horses into leadership?
Horses have this innate ability to understand and relate to and connect with people. And they do that without talking. So can you imagine if your teammates you couldn't speak with? I mean, that's the level of communication that's needed. So I enjoy jumping horses. And so that means you have a 1,200-pound animal that I'm sitting on and we're jumping, you know, multiple feet off the ground. And I love it because it gives me this sense of freedom, flying, soaring, and the connection with the horse. That's what inspires me. That's what I love about it. But it's been this amazing playground for both leadership as well as strategy for me. One of the reasons that I got back into horses and having a horse of my own after having my children was because I really wanted an outlet that was for me, where I wasn't losing myself serving others, but more for me. And it has enabled that so much. In bonding with a horse, I know there's even, we bonded because there are leadership horses and working with horses. So you have to communicate by, you know, even when you walk up, they're sensing your heart rate, they're sensing, you know, if you're nervous or things like that. When I still do competitions, so when I compete, I still get nervous. They certainly know that. One of the things I was looking for was a horse that I could be nervous, he would stay calm. But even just in selecting a horse that you can like look in their eyes and know what connection you have. So then there's all types of things that I'll play with in a leadership perspective of what if you can kind of give over direction or under direction and then what happens, or what if you try to do too much, or what if you try to do too little, or what if you, there's just so many ways of experimenting with leadership with a horse. And, you know, another reason that I wanted a horse was because leadership can be difficult and it can feel really lonely as well. And so I certainly tell my horse all about work and about things that are hard or frustrating or things like that. And I truly believe he always listens and he never talks back. And that's great to have an outlet where if you want me at my most creative, you want where I can forget about
sounds like a very recharging experience as well. I can certainly confirm that. We recently did, we closed actually a 1-year program for the top 12 leaders within a bank. And we, throughout the year, we have seen them in very different contexts. And of course, we did the typical work quests or we went offsite. But hand on heart, we have never seen them, never experienced them this focused and this present as during the 1 day when we took them to the horses and they were engaging and working with the horses. And it was incredible to see some of the bonds that were formed and also some of the attributes that we didn't even know they had. So it was also quite, in a way, uncovering to see how they engaged with it and some of the subtle nuances they took back for their own leadership style. So they had to, of course, do some activities with the horses. So they had to try and lead the horse and at the same time build real rapport. And what was fascinating is that everybody in the group afterwards, they had a fantastic time, needless to say, but everybody afterwards said, well, you know, I had a favorite among the horses. And it was, for most of them, was the first horse that they've been in contact with. And so there's also something that makes us fall in love.
I think that's really true. it was reminding me of maybe some specific things I've learned from my horse. His name is Calypso, and he's taught me, one, to be more assertive, or when to be more assertive as a leader. He is very well trained. He knows what to do. And yet there are times when he is like, are you really asking? Do you really mean it? And so it's taught me of when to be more assertive, and then also to be clear with my expectations. And I think those are both leadership lessons of, you know, I'll ask you to go this fast and jump from here. And it's like, is that what you really want? And I think there's also a confidence and how you react in crisis as well. As we know, horses are flight animals. And so, you know, out in the wild, they would be the prey for the predators. And so there's a staying calm under pressure. You know, as a leader, people will come and say, this disaster just happened. What should we do? And there's an element of, I'm calm. I am confident we'll figure this out.
Yeah. Yeah, it's just beautiful. It's really beautiful analogy. So for those of you interested, there is quite a bit of research about this as well. And I really recommend that you get in touch, especially my personal journey is to be more present. And I find that I can do that best when I'm connected with an animal at the moment. So this is also very helpful. And I know what you just said about the sort of probing, like, are you for real? Do you really mean it this time? This sort of pushing the boundaries and trying it out. And, you know, those experiences are human in a way. We experience that a lot. I see that we have a number of new joiners. Welcome, everybody. Just know you have a Q&A or an F&A if you have a German Zoom. If you click on it, you can just post your questions in there. I'm scanning it all the time. So if there's some questions from participants, I will ask them. And we will carry on with our conversation. Wanted to share it with everybody. Some of the items that I find, certainly in my coaching experience as well, and mind you, of course, people who come coaching, certainly in a more European context, they often, of course, are people of a certain breed, or they have certain challenges in their lives as well. So it might not be a general statement, but certainly in my coaching practice, what I find shapes us as people a lot are, of course, the positive, the resources, the strengths that we are given, some of the talents and skills. At the same time, one of the insights that always astounds me is that it's adversity in life, and oftentimes it's actually our opponents and not our mentors or sponsors who actually push us to give our life a new direction or to really make meaningful change. That's certainly true for my personal story, but it seems to be true in many other contexts. Are there some life experiences or some adversities where you would say, wow, this really had an impact on how I show up today as a leader, but maybe also just as a human being, that has really changed or impacted my life?
Yes, it's a personal story. So just so everybody's ready, I experienced postpartum hemorrhage with my first daughter. So when I was giving birth, and it was the most difficult portion of my life. And I survived, and it had an impact on me. So what happened? The doctors and nurses in the room did not realize that that's what was happening to me. So we went 2.5 hours while I was losing blood and blood volume, quite a bit of volume, before anything could be done. What that meant happened was that when it was realized what was happening, it was an emergent situation. And so we could not get into an operating room. And so everything had to be done on the fly without anesthesia. I credit my mom again for me being here, because I ended up calling her on the phone and I couldn't even speak anymore. And she had to come and got the help that I needed and held my hand while all of this happened. And gosh, it still even has an impact on me. I described it as a bookmark. It will always be like when you open a book and there's a page it just turns to, this will always be the page that my life turns to because it was such an experience in my life. But what I learned through this was that I am stronger than I ever knew. I can say that about me, but you know what I've learned is that every single person is stronger than they know. I also learned how I wanted to spend my time because life is short and you don't, I know everybody says it, but you don't know when it's going to end. And so I want to spend my time in the most meaningful way I can and living to my own values and making the difference that I want to make. My own values was critical. And there was a piece as well of realizing that I matter, that I'm valued too. And what I mean that is it was hard for me to experience that I was voicing, that I was in pain and that there was a problem for so many hours before anything was done. And it didn't have to be an emergent situation. It didn't have to be an emergency. And yet it was. And even after that happened, I then had to have blood transfusions. We then had to come back for another surgery 11 weeks later. And then I had to go into having a second daughter, not knowing if that would happen again. And gosh, going into that second one, I said goodbye to all my friends and family because you didn't know. And then I had a whole plan and everything. So it was a really challenging situation. I would wake up with panic attacks every night from the exact hours at which all this happened. And had to really work on realizing what was different from that situation, connecting that I wasn't in the hospital again. And anytime people wouldn't, I felt like people weren't listening. In my mind, it felt like life and death situation, even though it wasn't. And so how do you remind yourself that it's not a life and death situation? I was diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder at the time from this as well. So what I mean by that is from there, honestly, my ability to lead broadened in impact. And so that's the silver lining, the positive that comes out of this situation. I ended up starting to be able to be a resource for other people going through challenging times. I learned that so many people say, well, how can I help or what can I do? Well, gosh, I learned that the best thing that you can do for people is to just be there with them. You don't have to ask how to help. You don't have to know what to say, but you can just be with them. And that led to this ability to connect and be vulnerable with others that has enabled teams to accomplish so much because you're connecting at such a deep level. I think that's even what started our connection was this like deep, I don't start at the surface. I go deep with people. And then it almost led to this like leading at the organization of like, well, that's really hard. And you think it can't be done, but you can't kill me because somebody already tried and you can't. So you think we can't make a new product happen in record time? Let's do it. You think we can't figure out how to overcome this technical hurdle? I bet we can. You think we can't take this risk? Let's figure out how to take it. And it wasn't a, you know, trying to take high risk situations, but more like a courage. Imagine if you lived and you led without fear. Because so many times I still find that fear creeps in and it impacts how we lead. And so removed some of that impact of fear because I
I'm a bit speechless. I shouldn't as a host of a podcast, of course, but what you said that really touched me in the way that you share it, starting by just you said in the beginning that living courageously is something that very early on you made a self-commitment or self-promise to yourself. The courage to have a second pregnancy not knowing or knowing that there is a possibility that this might happen again, for me, it's just unfathomable in a way, right? It is this real commitment to give life and to share it, knowing everything that you went through the first time. It's really, really moving me. It's really touching me. And then the way you just translated it, one of my clients, he's a Paralympic medalist, an athlete, and he plays in the team sport. And he said to me, Sabine, we oftentimes already know the outcome of any match before it even starts, because it has a lot to do with, are we showing up to win? Because maybe we're not afraid that we have anything to lose, so we might be the underdogs and just fight for it. Or are we showing up with a fear of losing? And a fear of losing is something completely different. It puts us in a completely different mindset. We play a lot safer. We're not as bold. We don't push ourselves so much. And what he just shared really reminded me of what he shared with me, because just living and leading fearlessly, let's just go for it. Let's try it out. And it won't kill us. I love the connection between that. So this is also something that really resonated with me. You shared as part of this experience as well, that you spent some time really going back into your own values and trying to understand your own values more and learning about them. And as another part, which is to take yourself seriously and to really stand up for yourself, which I believe you did in the hospital. It's just in the heart, right? How do you make yourself heard in such a situation? Especially for those of you who do not know what the condition is, it's also excruciating pain. It's a very severe condition. And it's actually quite often missed in hospitals as well. So women are often really severely impacted by this. Can you share a bit about what you did to discover your own values, and what tips would you give to others from this experience about standing up for yourself?
Yes. So a little bit more context. You reference a diagnosis and a lot of pain. So it actually took another 7 years, even after everything I just described, to be diagnosed with adenomyosis. It was years, like you said, to actually get diagnosed. And it took me repeatedly advocating for myself. And I truly believe that when we think about innovations, especially healthcare innovations, I put that we are each a patient. So we are the true beneficiary, the patient. And for me, values, how did I spend time with those? The first is I worked with a wonderful human resources professional who recommended a value card sort. We did this exercise as part of a team building. And the idea was we had a deck of cards, and it was a modified deck of cards. So the deck of cards wasn't your typical, Jack, Queen, King and of Diamonds and Hearts. It was values on them. So values like loyalty, family, innovation, things like that. And it was meant to be really fast. So just in like a minute, take your 52 cards and separate them into, resonate and don't. And then take that and get it down to 10, and then take that and get that down to 5. And then you're down to like your top 5. And it was a way for me to reflect on immediate reaction. Cause I think there's so often that there's a time for spending time with what are your values, but there's also just, you have values. You just might not know what they are and be able to articulate them. And so that was trying to identify, to pull out those values that are already within. And then the second piece was then taking the time to sit with myself, my values, how I view myself. I committed then to meditation every day and actually spending quiet time reflecting on what are my values, maybe how have they evolved? Because that's the other thing. Your values change with you over time. We have lives where it impacts us. So that's how it worked for me, was both the immediate start, but then spending time with it and then discussing it with my the people in my life who I really care about and I feel like know me, because sometimes I'm not able to articulate my values as well as those around me. And they really help me process on them, think about them. And it did help me identify that I have some values like loyalty. I moved around a lot growing up. We moved every 3.5 years. That was for my dad's job. And it meant that loyalty ends up being a real core value for me. And I have friends then in every one of the locations that we lived in. But it also taught me to challenge assumptions and to form those connections quickly. Or other values like creativity. I never viewed myself as a very creative person until later in my life. And I say that because I always thought creative people were artists and writers, and I didn't view myself as an artist. My degree is in engineering. And yet, you can still be creative. It doesn't mean that you have to make a physical artistic output, but it can be creative in coming up with new solutions and ways of thinking about things and ways of working. And that is creativity as well.
Beautiful. Thank you so much for sharing. It's fascinating for me. I was also thinking it's true. I have some core values that change over time, and I have maybe some that are not quite so obvious. For me, it's abundance, for example. I come from a very, from a background of scarcity. Somehow when I grew up, there was not enough. There was not enough money. There was not enough time. There was a lot of pressure. And I feel my best when I feel that there is real abundance around me. Growth environments really stimulate me. Opportunities stimulate me. And just having the feeling that there's always going to be enough. There's sort of an inner core inside myself that just relies heavily on that principle that I don't need to worry because I will be provided for or with, or, you know, I will always find a way. And so this abundance is one core value of mine that might not be so obvious. I don't think you will pick that up from a website either, but it's something that has really a very strong influence, I guess, in the way that I live too.
What a great example. And how did you identify?
Oh, God. Well, actually, you know what I would say, Jenny? I think I turned something that people often criticized into something positive, right? So I in my family or even in relationships, I often had partners who said, oh, Sabine, you're spending so much money. You spend much money on dinner and you spend much money on travel. And my mom said, well, we're buying so many new clothes. And her conclusion was always that maybe I'm doing this because when I was younger, I was often wearing hard clothes. Because, you know, we didn't have much money, and we didn't always have the money. We had the money for clothes, but, you know, sometimes if they fit me, they would be passed along. And so I experienced that. And I realized what it actually is for me. It's not the spending itself that satisfies me. It's this feeling of experience and nourishment and opportunities, that really funnels a sort of an energy in me, and that I already had that when I was very young. I was quite inventive as well in that. So I believe I had my first job with probably 11 or 12 years old. And I remember at that time as a student, I made a lot of money being a tutor because I was tutoring in accounting and grew up in a very small town. So there weren't many tutors for accounting. I believe I was the only one. And I was a bit of a teacher's pet, which always helped. So when parents showed up and you know, talked to the teacher in frustration about accounting and that they can't really help their children, he would just pass my name along. So it was a very profitable business for me at the time. And I just remember that this insight really sparked something in me, that it's not something to criticize, but it's more an inner mindset. Abundance for me is really like an inner awareness or an inner mindset or something that I can just tap into. And I don't think without the external criticism, I would have gotten there. I might not have been aware of it, but it's been a huge engine in my life for certainly decades, I would say.
What an amazing example of how you responded to criticism, but then also went deeper into what abundance meant for you.
Yeah, I really think that I'm very strength-based, and I think it's worth being strength-based. And of course, it's important to live our potential. It's also just important when we face critical situations or criticism to really analyze it for what it is, with it, which is another person's view on you. So it's filtered and colored through their lens. And if it touches us, then it's important maybe to find out what is the core truth in this. And why do I get in a resonance with it? And at the same time, does it really hold true for me? So is it a source for me, or is it really something that actually drains me or is a negative for me? So yeah, this is a very concrete example of standing up for myself, I would say, because you shared that, right? Love that connects to standing up for ourselves, which is something like every no to the outside world is a yes to ourselves, or for ourselves. And I think that that's also something I'm working on. I'm trying to work on. I don't always master it, by the way. I don't know, those of you who see me on video, I still don't have a halo, unfortunately. I'm working on that too, but it hasn't happened yet.
I love that question. It is so hard to say no.
It is hard to say no. It's really hard to say no. And sometimes we don't have to say no, actually. Sometimes we can just say yes, but say yes to the right things. I don't know why I have so many quotes in my head, stopping my head talking to you today, Jenny. But Viktor Frankl actually said that. He said, a yes replaces many no's. So it's true that sometimes when we say yes to something, we indirectly say no to a lot of other options as well. So you don't always have to say no, because it might be harder, but you can just say yes to something. We have a question that helps us transition a bit into leadership at Gore. And the Gore culture as well, which many people are incredibly interested in. And I would say a couple of more things as a transformation advisor, maybe, or transformations architect, about holding up this company as a role model, and what might be some of the pitfalls, actually. So remind me if I forget to talk about this, because I think that's also very important to understand. And it's great just to talk to someone who lives in this beautiful ecosystem and can share with us, what does it feel like? What is it like to be in that? So the question we have in the chat is it possible to be happy in a company that has different values than I do? Have you ever had a case like this in your role as a leader or in your personal experience?
Ooh, that is a good question. And I think it's a nuanced answer. First aspect I'd say is, for me, having spent time and being very clear on what my own personal values are, and then understanding the company's values, there has, for me, to be a degree of alignment in those two. And I say that in then unlocking my full passion and my engagement and energy. You can see I like to come with energy. I'm known for that. And it doesn't get fully unlocked unless there's at least a pretty strong degree of alignment in those values. And how much then, you could ask? You know, I'm going to say, if I'm quantifying it, something like 75-80% alignment. And the nuance to that is, that doesn't mean that we're 100% in alignment between my own personal values and a company's. But it means that there's a strong degree. And then I think it's the conversation of, well, when I interpret it differently, or, you know, why, or what did you mean by that decision, or what was the intent? So I guess leading with seeking to understand. I'm a really curious person, and a learner at heart. So I like to learn how others think, how others experience the culture, how others think about their decisions and how they shape and form the culture. And so that's the way I approach when there's a sense or a feeling of misalignment. And has it ever happened to me where there's been misalignment? When there's misalignment, I like to bring it up as I'm concerned because of this. Do you share that concern? So a similar seeking to understand from a perspective of curiosity. And then if there's truly just, you know, we're in 180 degree different directions, that doesn't work for me. I know it can for others, but not for me. It just doesn't work. But there are certainly decisions where I didn't necessarily support them or they didn't make sense to me at the beginning. And either then I can understand more so that I see the future direction, I see the potential, and then I can become on board, of course. And unlock again, for me, it's about unlocking that energy, that passion that I'm known for.
Thank you much for the question. And thank you for everyone who is with us. I just want to do a shout out again. We had the largest numbers of participants actually in a live podcast. It's only our second one, but this is people are clearly interested in learning more about you and learning more about Gore, and this is what we're going to do. So if I read your profile on LinkedIn correctly, if I did my homework correctly, you went from academia directly into Gore. Is that right? So talk to us about that, because crossing over from one very specific culture, academia, into this specific culture, what was that like? What was that experience? Did you experience like culture shock? What did it feel like? What are some of the things you remember about crossing over, about this transition in your life?
First, I'd say that many of us made a similar type of transition, and there was a theory or approach that you could learn the Gore culture or how to live it without being shaped. Like coming from academia, maybe you were more moldable, if that makes sense. And what I would say is I came from doing graduate work. So I did a PhD in bioengineering, and it was a very, I had to be self-sufficient. I had to drive my own work and accomplishing it in my own time frame. So designing my own experiments, getting them done. I had a wonderful advisor who I still see as a mentor, and she let me have the space to direct my own path forward. She also supported me knowing that I didn't want to stay in academia, that I wanted to go into industry. And so that type of environment lent really well to Gore, because Gore is also you make and keep your own commitment. You have to then be self-motivated. And people aren't looking over your shoulder to make sure things get done. I had a similar type of graduate school experience. And so that felt like I could understand. The other thing I'd say is people ask me about like politics. There's politics in academia, as we all know. There's politics in all organizations as well. And so a lot of people ask me about that. It maybe shows up differently, but it happens everywhere about, you know, who knows each other and how decisions are getting made. Maybe what was different was then the magnitude. So the magnitude of the number of people in the Gore organization and how we think about decisions being made. And that then there's many, you know, one of the great principles or ways of experiencing Gore that I have is how enrolled people are when decisions are made. But that can also have the flip side of sometimes meaning decisions take longer. So how do you make sure people are enrolled, which generally means that more people are participating in making a decision, but that when you make a decision, people are committed to it and will put all their energy behind whatever decision it is, but yet not let it take too long. And I think it really goes back to, one of Gore's cultural influences was theory X versus theory Y. So many people know this as the carrot or the stick. And since we talked about horses, that really resonates with me. I always take a carrot and I always have a stick. And there are times when you use each. And I guess I'm just not fundamentally a stick only person, meaning I don't respond best if somebody is just using a stick on me. and I don't believe that others do. And so how do you actually create an environment where people are motivated and wanting to make a difference? More of that carrot type mentality, which resonates with me personally. I think that came well from academia, but then that shows up in my 12 years of experience at Gore as well.
I did. It's also a bit of a tradition now in Gen AI. I actually worked with GPT-4 on doing some research, but also asked GPT-4 to write a poem about Gore, just using the link reader to the Gore website. And I have to say, it was the first time ever that I read the poem probably 4 or 5 times, because it came back too poetic. It was a bit esoteric almost. It didn't sound like a GPT-4 described a company or a business. It sounded just like something else. And I think this is the feeling as well when visiting the website. I can really relate to GPT-4's experience of extracting from this website. It has so much ethics on it. It has so much insight and thinking on it. It has a lot of legacy on it. So I'm just going to read GPT-4's last and final attempt of writing a poem and the best of about Gore and Gore's culture. The real deal at Gore is the title of the poem. At Gore, we've got 4 rules we live by. Freedom and fairness under the same sky. Commitment's the glue, keeps us in line, and waterline's there, so we all do fine. We're called associates, not just staff. Working here is more than a good laugh. We're a lattice, connected but free, like a big family, as you can see. From Gore-Tex boots to medical gear, we've made cool stuff year after year. Started small, but look at us now, a global name, we're still wow. So that's
Gore. I love it.
In a nutshell. I love it. I will send it to you afterwards. I love it too. So that's Gore in a nutshell. You see, a place where you can be you and I can be me. It's not just a job or a corporate chore. It's a way of life. That's the spirit of Gore.
Wow, that was beautiful. And you know, maybe some things that stood out to me. That you can be you and me can be me, you know, that I like this idea of you come with your strengths and your skills and you want to work in an environment where you feel like your strengths are utilized and you can apply your skills and experience. And I really appreciate that.
I thought this really nailed it for me as well. And of course, there's some keywords that I want to talk to you about, the whole idea around being an associate versus an employee or direct report. Lattice, right? Which of course, for anyone who has a degree like you in bioengineering will get immediately what it is. I had to Google it. So right, how do you lead an organization by that? But before that, I just want to give a disclaimer that I feel is really important to make. I'm working with a number of clients on their people and culture transformation. And of course, Gore is often hailed as a lighthouse, to use your word, yeah, a beacon of an innovative culture that is incredibly impactful and something to aspire to. And generally, I have not lived in the ecosystem of Gore, but from the outside in, absolutely, I would subscribe to that. I think the challenge is, though, when other companies with a legacy that is very different try to aspire or try to become Gore, it's not going to be possible. And the reason why it's not possible is because in any culture transformation, in any journey like this, you always have to honor the legacy. And from the outset, the system was established by different ground rules, very different ground rules. And it's got something, of course, to do with being a family-owned business, but not only, because many family-owned businesses are run like corporations today. I think it's more the mindset around co-creation, trying things out, being quite lean, the way that especially, of course, in the founding times, people were hired who fell on, well, a really, really hard side of life at that time, and who were hired for their hunger and their abilities and were given chances. There's something quite unique in the way in the root or the foundation was created that, of course, helped to shape the organization now many decades on. So it's a great example, but it's not transferable. That's the only, or not 100% transferable. That's the only disclaimer I really would like to make, because if large corporations try to aspire to become that in itself, which actually many try, I don't think that they set themselves up for success. I think it's really important to understand what is the fabric, to use that word, what is the fabric that your organization is made of, and how can you adjust that to be more aligned with who you want to be, what you think is going to make you successful and survive in the future. So this is just something that's very dear to my heart that I would like to share before we talk about the culture. And still, there will be some ideas and some thoughts that are absolutely transferable and that can absolutely be implemented in any system and should even be implemented in systems, because most companies face the same challenges. There is a lack of talent. They struggle to really acquire talent as well. So there is really some issues around talent acquisition and retention. It's a fast-paced environment that many systems are not set up to deal with well. And so by that, they actually lose a lot of opportunities. And I would say many systems are not fit for the future because they still operate on a predominantly capitalist mindset, you know, which is probably not going to be the best model for the future. So I know at Gore, sustainability is a core element, and you and I connected around this topic as well. So those are some of the framing thoughts that I just wanted to share before we talk more about Gore. And I've talked a lot. Jenny, anything you would like to respond to that, and feel free to challenge anything that I just shared.
The first thing I'd say on your disclaimer, if I actually go back to your GPT-4 poem, it was about you being me and you being you and me being me. And I think that that is the same for organizations as well, that it doesn't work if Gore tries to be somebody else, and it doesn't work if somebody else tries to be Gore, and same for the individual leaders. So I think the way I take it is more, what can I learn from you? And how you show up as a leader and your experience as a leader and translate that into me. But it's not that I should try to become you. And I've tried to do that. And I've even gotten feedback, you know, earlier in my career about being more like somebody else. And I think it's more about, what do I learn from somebody else? Maybe how they show up, how they interact, but not try to be them.
And how
can organization.
Exactly. And how can I apply that in my context?
Yeah.
So let's use some of the keywords. I would like to maybe start, I have a couple, but I would like to maybe start with this concept of lattice. So this unique lattice organizational structure, right? It's designed to eliminate traditional chains of command in the system, but how does it effectively work? Because I can see that networking and followership are really important in this context. So how does it work? How do you live it every day? What does this mean? What does it taste like, feel like, look like?
Yeah, so lattice is the one I would have recommended starting with, and you didn't even ask for my thoughts on that. So that was a great place to start. Lattice, to me, the first aspect of the way I've lived it and experienced it is in a network of those I'm connected with. So it means that I could schedule a time to connect with anyone at Gore, any of the associates. It doesn't matter what role they have or what, you know, in other companies you would call it, what title you might have or how much experience you might have. You can connect with anyone. And that's really amazing to, one, get work done more quickly, more effectively. But then also, too, to be able to learn from others and build your knowledge and challenge your approach. And so it means then that you can have this vast resource of people and experts out there. So that's the first way Because I know in many other organizations, it's, you know, you can only talk to people of a certain level, or you need to talk to a certain level before you can talk to others. You can just talk to people. And that's amazing to me and rewarding. It also means then that people are really encouraged to build their lattice. The closest other word that others might be familiar with is network there, like build your network. So similar of making more connections, and that there is value in taking the time to make those connections. In fact, many times when people start new to the organization, that's the encouragement, go build your lattice. So that's how it will show up and maybe show up differently for others. I think when people join then, or people on the outside when they're working with Boar, will often say then, what's the org chart, or how do I know who to talk with? And that's where it can be more confusing or maybe difficult to figure out from the external perspective. There isn't an org chart. There still are leaders, like you mentioned, leadership and followership. So there still are leaders. So there is some structure.
No titles. I can't put you in a box, right? That's the challenge.
But I love that, actually. So I guess the first thing I'd say is you even introduced me for business operations. I use that almost as an external translation for people to know what I do. And you're right. So there aren't formal titles like that. And it can be then tricky to figure out what people do. But if you build your lattice and connect with people, and then you really know their strengths and where they focus, then it is even more empowering. Because to your point of you can't put people in a box, I believe that people are so much more than even what we do at work, and we have so many more dimensions. And so I don't want to put people in a box. You know, if anything, I want them to be less than a box. So that's certainly what really resonates with me. And I know then many people will say, well, then how do I figure out who to connect with at Boar? And you find a Boar associate and they'll make sure you get connected, is typically my experience. And it might be even reaching out to multiple people, but then you get to meet more and get even further connections. So that's what lattice means to me, is making these connections, the one-on-one interactions, and using expertise from each person.
And this is a very practical, pragmatic question. So everybody can reach out to everyone, which is fantastic. I don't know how you find it. In my day, the one thing that is missing most of the time is time. Time for myself, time to think. And typically, my days are really back to back. And so even if someone reached out in such a setting and said, hey, you know, can we have a chat? With the best intentions, trying to make that time, it might take some time, or, you know, in my old finance industry thinking, you know, you might not be rapid enough to respond. So how is that lived in a very concrete way? Do you block certain times in your week just to be available for these type of conversations, or when people want to approach you, or how do you navigate that and manage that?
The first thing I'd say is it's not like I have a magical time machine and we have more time at Boar. That would be amazing. That's not true.
You can work on that.
Okay. That would be a great, impactful product. But so it is a challenge. What I mean is I relate to that. It is a challenge that I face, that each person faces as well. And it's all about how we value and invest our time. And that's our greatest resource that we have. So it shows up to me in two ways. The first is how you value your time, and that you actually value making those connections. And thus, if you value it, you're going to figure out how to make time for it. The second piece is the more tangible, when do you make the time? One of the ways is at the beginning of a meeting. You know, at the beginning of a meeting, when everybody is joining, and, you know, there'll often be a conversation of like, oh, what, how's the weather where you are? How are you doing? Is common question. But that's actually a time where people can build their lattice and go deeper. So maybe it's not how's the weather, how are you doing? But people know each other. You referred to like family. So people know, like, how was your son's lacrosse game on Saturday? Or how was that, theatrical performance you went to last night, or you tried a new dinner restaurant. How did it go? Should I go? So I think it's, we're all familiar with taking the time at the beginning of a meeting, but it is actually not just rushing by it, valuing that time and investing in the specific connections with individuals.
That, and it links neatly to the core guiding principles, right? We heard them in a poem as well. Freedom, fairness, commitment, but fairly clear. I'm sure the interpretation and the way you live it is unique and specific to Gore Does Gore. But the one that I really had to read up on and that I find so curious is borderline. So can you explain a little bit about borderline? What does borderline mean, represent? How do you live it?
Yes. So the first, the idea of a borderline is that if we're all on the same boat, which is one of the things they believe, we're all on the same boat together, similar to think of it like we're all on the same team, that type of idea. So we're all on the same boat. And you know, when you have a boat and it's sitting in the water, there's a line where the water is, and you have a portion of the boat below the water, and then you have boat above the water. And the idea is, if you are going to poke a hole in the boat, so you're going to take a risk, for example, and, you know, business, you take risks. How do you know when a product is ready? How do you search for sale? How do you know when, there's all types of risks that you're taking. It's decisions you're making every day. So if you're going to poke a hole in the boat, make sure that it is not below the waterline. Or if it is, then get those who have the correct waterline. And what I mean by the correct waterline is those who maybe have more experience or broader commitment would have a different waterline than those new to the organization. So if you're going to poke a hole that might be below your waterline, then you can ask for help from those who have a different waterline. The idea then is to, you know, one is not sink the ship. So, you know, we take a shared risk if we're poking a hole below the waterline. But the other is actually the empowerment to poke the hole then. If it's not below the waterline, take the risk, make the decision, poke the hole. And that actually, that second piece was something I learned after having been at Gore for a while. It was also often, I had often experienced waterline as a risk aversion. So don't poke the hole in the boat. But no, it was really about living in a way that if it's not below the waterline, do it. We talked about living without fear. So take that risk, learn from it. And that's how you stay agile and creative.
That image I love a lot more than how it's explained in literature. I love that. You can dig a hole if it's above the waterline, and if it's below the waterline, try and find someone with a boat where they have a different waterline, or maybe think about whether you should really be doing that. That's a very powerful metaphor. I read a quote from Brett Snyder. He's now CEO, and he's the grandson of the founders. That I really liked. It resonated with me because it speaks to another piece around passion. He says, the Gore culture at its heart is about the pleasure and satisfaction that comes from working together. And in ways free of too many rules and too many distractions, when you can really move quickly and solve problems and make a lot of decisions, it's a great way of working together that brings out our human potential. You talked a lot already about the potential and creating an environment where people can really bring all the different facets, who they are, into the lattice and help connect around that. It's the pleasure and the satisfaction piece that I find really striking. And I would like to connect that maybe with the term associates. So how do you, in the system, as leadership, especially create environments that allows people to take pleasure and satisfaction from their work, especially when you consider them associates? So they have a stake, right? They have a stake in the business. They have an investment in the business.
Well, you described it really well. So the idea is, as an associate, you're not just told what to do, but you're living as if you are part of the organization, because you have a vested interest. You are part of it. Think even similarly, how would you invest your own money? Okay, well, then that's how you should invest the organization's money. And so the associate idea really is about using a word to signify that it's more than just you work here, or it's more than, you know, you're told what to do and accomplish, but more you can unlock your potential, show up with your whole self, utilize all your strength to reach your potential in the organization. And that shows up differently for each person. So that's the idea behind, at least how I experience the term associate. And I think in your quote, you really got to why. Because again, to me, the people are the greatest asset that any organization has. And people are amazing. We talked in the beginning about how people are stronger than we know. They're more creative than we know. So if we can really unlock people and unlock their potential, then I really believe we can accomplish amazing things in this world. And so it's about getting people their passion, their energy, their excitement behind their work, and then creating an environment where that can thrive, where it's fostered. So it's not that roadblocks are always getting in the way, or you know, they're always being asked for certain things. More, it's this environment where, imagine a plant and the plant really is thriving. You can tell when the plant is thriving, when it's getting all the resources that it needs.
We have another question in the chat, and I think this also links to the innovation leadership that Gore holds. Right? You're consistently recognized as one of the most innovative companies on the planet. And the question that is in the chat is, how do you deal with failures in Gore or within the Gore culture? So what happens with mistakes or failures, maybe even epic failures? What happens then?
The first thing is there are always failures, meaning any organization, any person, I personally, there are always failures. And for me, it's all about failures are an opportunity to learn. And it almost to the point of, I don't even think about or describe failures. I think about it as learning. And like I said, I'm a lifelong learner. And so even when there are big, epic failures, especially like where we'll go after these big challenges and try to make a difference in the world, it doesn't always work out. So from them, I think it has always been worth it, though. Worth it because we developed talent. We learned something that always comes back to be applicable in another way. Even if it's a whole nother product line, a whole nother market or industry that's being served, you never know how it's going to show up, what connection is going to be had, but it always ends up being worth it. Because I believe that the diverse perspective and diverse experiences make us more creative, and we're able to find more solutions to challenges in this world. And so failure just makes us stronger. I know that that's said all the time, but it really creates this learning opportunity. So how that might show up, many organizations do things like after action reviews and really talk about, you know, what would you repeat? What would you change? What did we learn? So of course, you know, that type of action would be taken. And it's not used to then punish people, but more, how can you apply what you learned? And it's connected back to that waterline principle. You might have poked a hole and it was above the waterline. So what'd you learn from it? That's the point.
Yeah, and I think this connection is very powerful because you said it, many companies would state the same, but in reality, there are hefty sanctions on making mistakes, certainly for failures, right? And so it's truly how it is lived. I think the waterline is a great analogy to help people make a decision as well about which risks are worth being taken and which risks might not be the ones that you want to take. We have so many questions in the chat right now. And so people are warming up towards the end. I'm gonna take one more question from the chat and one more question that I think is quite relevant to all of our future, but also very much to your, I think, personal mission and something we connected with. And if that's okay for everybody who has asked questions, I actually really want to lead with that because I want to give it the space it deserves. I want to talk to you about environmental stewardship and what that really means to you personally and to the organization. Because I know that you at Gore firmly believe that you take the long-term view and you don't sacrifice your beliefs on short-term missions or short-term goals. I also know that you have invested substantially in thinking about a new horizon, a new way of operating, and certainly about how to lead this field and how to maybe lead a whole industry in this field. So it would be great if you just shared some insights around the topic of environmental stewardship.
Yes, great question. So especially given my time with Gore-Tex Fabrics that we all know and love, I see that in the apparel industry, the biggest challenge that the industry faces right now is how to have a more sustainable future. What I mean by that is the apparel industry is a leading industry in carbon impact in the world. And, you know, when apparel is manufactured, the way it's made and how much of it is thrown away, goes into landfill, all of that has an impact, an environmental impact in our world. And we all know that climate change is a huge challenge that we're all facing. It's probably shown up to impact us each personally in the weather and impacts to our families as well. So given the apparel industry's significant role in the climate change crisis and the environment, we set out to address the biggest challenges that the industry faces. And we also see that Gore plays a unique role in the apparel industry too, because we both manufacture product for a number of well-known brands. We work with about, you know, hundreds of brands that you all probably wear right now. I love. And so we get to connect or influence even greater than our size. And that's what we are seeking to make a difference with. If we can solve the greatest challenge for the industry, and we can have the impact greater than our size. To me, that's leading with science and engineering and doing it for a greater purpose. So I think, you know, ways that show up is innovating with new materials. We have some new materials that still deliver the performance that you would expect from Gore, so the waterproof and breathability, and yet have less of an environmental impact, as an example. And we'll do it in a number of other ways too. But that is the mission. That's why I joined this part of Gore and continue to direct my energy toward solving the biggest challenge that the apparel industry faces. And the apparel industry is a big industry. And we all have such an emotional connection with the clothing we wear. Like, I bet each of us could remember, you know, something we wore on a specific notable day and experience.
Yes, it's true. And I have one more small activity for both of us before it closes out, but I want to read something that came in the chat, because it really resonates with me and I really echo that. We had a comment. I have no question. I just want to thank you for your time and that you shared your story, your values, and your experiences in such a heart-touching way. You, in capital letters, are inspiring and amazing. Stay vulnerable, agile, and creative. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Deck of cards with 33 questions. So the way we used to play this game is that you call out any number between 1 and 33, and I will count it and read the question to you, and that will be our closing question. I have no control over what it's going to be. It's going to be okay for the time of day, let me put it like that. And you have a veto right. So if you don't like the question, we're from 1 to 33, and I will try and count it out for us.
The number is 8. Number 8.
Yeah, so synchronized. I was really thinking of age.
I hope it's a good one, man.
I'm enjoying this a lot, Jenny. Me too. All right, hold on. I'm going to do this correct. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. This is the image.
On the okay. Top. That image is going to give me a clue, an idea.
Yeah, sometimes it's related, but not always. But the question is, the first song to come into my head right now is...
My kids are singing in a choir and they are singing Joyful, Joyful, We Adore Thee. And so we have been practicing. You guys might see Billard Eindry is there practicing music. And so we've been singing lots of Joyful, Joyful, We Adore Thee.
Well, that's fantastic. Thank you so much, Jenny. Is there anything I should have asked you? We should have asked you that we didn't ask. Is there anything you would like to share? Because you will have the last word before Dadi is going to close us out of this live podcast.
First, here and get to talk with you. And second is the reality that leadership and showing up to your values is a daily choice and challenging daily. So maybe our conversation made it sound easy or made it sound obvious. And the reality is it's not. It's not easy. It means that there are daily choices in how we spend our time and how we show up. And that's how we continue to create a culture and a leadership style and approach.
Yeah, I could add 100%. I said it throughout our conversation. I just want to say it again. Thank you so much for your time, your insight into the phenomenal ecosystem that you influence and work in every single day. It's such a pleasure to have our connection, and I'm so immensely grateful for that. So this is just a very personal note. And Daddy's wearing glasses now, so it's getting serious because she's closing on us. Daddy, please, could you take over?
Of course. Wow, this conversation felt so special to me. Our deepest gratitude to you, Jenny, for these profound insights and the personal answers that added so much heart to the conversation and made it truly inspiring and uplifting. And of course, many thanks go out to our community for their engaging questions. And if you have any lingering thoughts or additional questions, don't hesitate to reach out to us via email or through our social media platforms. Wrapping up for tonight, this is Tatiana Nish wishing you all a relaxing evening. I hope to see you at our next event that you can check out on our website. And until then, stay curious and inspired. Thank you.